Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, April is a notorious month for genocide and mass human rights abuses. We'll analyze the forces of genocide and the means of preventing future genocide. But first, is this pandemic, the novel coronavirus, changing governance in the United States? Is it bringing about a different form of federalism? With us is Professor Sanford Levinson. Sandy Levinson is a professor of law and political science at the University of Texas. He's the author of Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It. Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, and approximately 400 articles, book reviews, and commentaries in professional and popular journals. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Sandy Levinson. It's so good to have you back here.
Delighted to be here.
You know, this pandemic, the novel coronavirus, has again seemed to sort of demonstrate the complicated nature of the government in the U.S. Some people say it's exposed the weaknesses, and some people say it has exposed the strengths of the federalist system. What do you think?
Any question like that has to take into context the fact that we have the world's worst president. And that, you know, the strengths of the federal system are necessary because the president himself is so completely and utterly dismal. And so there is no notion of genuine national leadership being given. You know, the standard argument for the national government, both in 1787 and now, is the kind of externalities argument, that it's fine to have states responsible for what they can effectively regulate where there are no externalities. But if there are externalities, then you want some sort of national coordination so that New Zealand, I assume, can by and large have its own policies without affecting Australia. But I assume that Victoria can't have its own policies that don't affect New South Wales, and so on and so forth. And we obviously have many, many more states than Australia does. And so the consequences of idiotic decisions made by certain state governors can be quite significant. That even if you're heartless enough to say what goes on in Georgia should stay in Georgia, and if the Georgia governor wants to sacrifice a certain number of Georgia lives, then so be it. I don't live in Georgia. Why should I care? The fact is that decisions made in Georgia will in fact impinge on not only states immediately near Georgia, but also New York, even California. So we're in desperate need of coherent national policies. We're not getting them, so therefore there is the fallback on some really very, very admirable state governors, most of them Democratic, but some of them Republican, and they're rising to the occasion. But I don't think this vindicates federalism so much as exemplifies why it is disastrous to have somebody like Donald Trump as a president.
I suppose the argument that one could make about giving some positivity to federalism would be like, in the case of having a disastrous president like Donald Trump.
Right. I mean, it's the insurance policy argument, but you realize that it's a very mixed insurance policy because New York, California are far, far better off because they have Andrew Cuomo and Gavin Newsom's governors. But the states of Georgia, South Dakota, et cetera, are much worse off. And as I said a few moments ago, if it were only the South Dakotans or only the Georgians who had to live, or in this case, die with the consequences of their own decisions as to whom to elect, then you could say, okay, this is what federalism is. But the fact is, we're not insured against dumb decisions made at the state level. And I think that's the problem right now. You know, I'm glad we have the states given the sheer incompetence of the national leadership, but I don't think it vindicates the idea of a very strong federalism, in which, you know, which might be defined as the ability of states to resist really sensible policies that right. are being adopted by a trustworthy national government.
So one of the things that seems to be shifting, and this is the thing I found most interesting and what I wanted to talk with you about, is how some states are forming these new sort of alliances, like California with Washington and Oregon, and I think New York with New Jersey, and I can't remember if it was New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And is this going to change at all what our federalism looks like?
Who knows? I mean, I've quoted more than once what may or may not be the apocryphal statement of Zhou Enlai about the French Revolution and the consequences of the French Revolution. It's too early to tell. You know, we won't know for years what the consequences of this current episode will be. I have speculated, much to the consternation of very close friends and colleagues, that the United States might in fact disintegrate, that there is no very good reason for the people of what I now sometimes call Pacifica to wish to remain in the Union. What are they getting out of it? That, I think, is extreme. I would be really quite shocked if the Union dissolved while I'm alive. There's a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times by Richard Kleindler, I think is his last name. He has a book coming out, I think, in July on the fragmentation of America, in which he suggests that what you're talking about, that is these interstate alliances, really take us back to the Articles of Confederation. And in fact, a couple of governors have evoked the Articles of Confederation. And it's very, very interesting because the Articles of Confederation were described by Hamilton in Federalist 15 as imbecilic, precisely because they didn't allow for a vigorous national government. Hamilton, I think it's fair to say, basically despised the states, particularly in 1787. You can argue that later his views changed a bit. Madison in 1787 had very little that was good to say about states. I view the 10th Federalist as the most anti-federalism document in the canon, because he describes states basically as cesspools of faction that are running roughshod over the liberties of the people. And the only way to guard against that, because you can't really cure the states, the only way to solve that is the so-called extended republic. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you can argue that Madison changed his mind in 1798, 1799, or later. So this is an enduring controversy in American political thought, in American politics. But to put it mildly, returning to the Articles of Confederation is only slightly less radical than simply seceding and setting up some brand new countries. If Joe Biden is elected, I think that he will effectively lead the net, because this isn't going to go away. This is not going to be restricted to a problem of the Trump administration. He will exercise effective national leadership. You're not going to hear Democratic governors talk about the need to enter into Articles of Confederation like alliances against the national government. If Donald Trump is reelected, then who knows what will happen?
I recall you saying historically that, you know, the problem is the Constitution. Of course, that's what gave us this presidency in the first place.
Right.
So now when we look at it, I guess part of what you probably were also saying is it's the confusion in the document because it's not clear.
Sure. The convention was a gathering of 55 people who barely knew one another, who disagreed on a number of essential issues, and who had to engage in ungainly compromises. You know, it's the classic thing of the camels being horses designed by committees. And Madison believed that the Senate, or the part of the Senate that required equal voting power for Virginia and Delaware, was evil. But he said it was a lesser evil. The greater evil would have been no Constitution at all. And some of the people who opposed slavery also made very similar arguments, so that nobody got exactly what he, and I use the word he advisedly, wanted out of Philadelphia. In a book I wrote, I distinguished very sharply between the Constitution of Settlement and the Constitution of Conversation. So the Constitution does settle some things, for better or worse. Presidents serve four-year fixed terms. We can't fire our presidents the way you can fire your prime minister. It is an unfortunate truth that each state has equal voting power in the Senate. The response to somebody who says, well, it's unfair, it's indefensible, is simply, what part of two do you not understand? So the argument can't be made from within the Constitution that it is, you know, illegitimate. But then what lawyers and law schools obsess about really, you know, 100% is what I call the constitutional conversation. Who in the world really knows exactly what powers Congress has? Who really knows what powers states have? What the First Amendment means, what the Equal Protection Clause means. The United States Constitution, unlike a number of constitutions around the world, does not specify powers of the states to any significant degree. I mean, some constitutions say states will run their education system, or states in India can decide what languages they'll speak, or indeed states can have their own religions, etc. What we say is that states can't be mushed together or taken apart without their consent, which is not nothing, but it's not a crucial issue of governance. So that American federalism is what philosophers would call an essentially contested concept.
Yeah.
And it's been that way from the beginning.
So medical scholars who also have legal backgrounds have argued that this type of pandemic is precisely the reason why we need a strong federal government, arguing against this.
Right.
And yet, in some ways, because we have this, as you call, incompetent president, and I agree with you, in some ways our savior has been the states.
Sure. You know, it's not clear exactly what the moral of that story is, though, even if one agrees with it. I have read, for example, that some gangs in Mexico or the mafia in Italy are currently distributing food to the poor, or, you know, are otherwise behaving in what one would regard as public-spirited, other-regarding ways. You know, one moral of that is the old expression, don't judge people only by the worst things they do, also take into account, you know, better things they do. All saints have feet of clay, and almost all villains, Hitler may be the exception, but almost all villains on occasion do good things. But I don't know what moral one takes from that with regard to designing a government. I'm not only a lawyer, I'm a political scientist, and in my old age, I think I do define myself much more as a political scientist than as a lawyer, as illustrated by the fact that I'm very, very prone to using the term frequency distribution. That is, you know, over 100 events, would you put more confidence in a centralized government or a fragmented government to solve a given problem? If your answer is that you think 51% of the time the states are more likely to get it right, then you ought to support a quite robust form of federalism. If, on the other hand, you think, well, in truly exceptional situations like this, thank God for the states, that's still not a good argument for adopting strong federalism as a general policy.
At the very beginning of this conversation, we were talking about what happens in Georgia affects, you know, people in Texas, affects people in California, affects people in New York. Do the states have any power at all to limit some of that?
This is a fascinating who knows and who will decide question. That, you know, I can cite you some cases that talk about the fact that we're a union, capital U, and therefore that implies a right to travel from state to state. There's a 1941 case in which California tried to exclude Okies, that is, immigrants from the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, but also, you know, the Midwest, by saying, we don't want you if you're poor. You know, this is the basis of John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath. The Supreme Court held unanimously that California couldn't do that. They didn't agree, interestingly enough, on exactly why not. Four said it was because of the Commerce Clause, or five said it was the Commerce Clause. Four said it was because of the Privileges or an Immunities Clause that seems to suggest that states have to be hospitable to at least the citizens of all other states. On the other hand, there are cases going back to 1824 to 1837 and afterward that talk about quarantine and that say that one of the things that a state can do to protect the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens is to ban diseased cattle. That's the easiest explanation, the easiest example. So if you can ban diseased cattle or cattle you have some reasonable reason to believe might be diseased because they're coming, say, from stockyards that had hoof and mouth disease, even if this particular cow doesn't yet have it, you could still ban it. So why can't you apply that to people? That, you know, the argument is that we can't keep out people from Oklahoma because they're too poor, but what if we say, well, it's not because they're too poor, it's because we think they might be infected. And, you know, there might be good reason, frankly, to want to try to keep out people from Oklahoma or Georgia or South Dakota because their governors have been remarkably irresponsible with regard to adopting statewide policies. Senator Elizabeth Warren's brother from Oklahoma died yesterday. He died, according to the headlines, he died of coronavirus. Now, I have no idea whether he would also have died in New York or in California, but it at least raises grounds to wonder if he was more likely to get sick in Oklahoma than were he living in California or in New Zealand. And so if that's the case, and especially since we know that a lot of people who are carriers are asymptomatic and therefore can infect other people, even though they themselves are getting through this just fine, then is that a good reason for lifting the drawbridges? As a legal academic, I would have no trouble teaching a class arguing both sides and, you know, asking students which of these arguments they thought was stronger. And I wouldn't dare to say that, well, I will confidently predict that the Supreme Court will say this rather than that. Or for that matter, if the Supreme Court does say that states can't lift drawbridges, would the states necessarily acquiesce, or would they say, we're not going to accept a 5-4 opinion, that we have to expose ourselves to these dangers? You know, if the president makes this, I think, idiotic argument that we have to shut down immigration because of the risk of infection from outsiders, why can't a state say this with regard to outsiders coming from elsewhere? I mean, I have no idea what New Zealand is doing with regard to, you know, not only immigrants, but visitors from abroad. It is indeed an island right, you know, in the middle of the Western Pacific, and it's hard to get to.
The other thing I wanted to get to in terms of these state pacts that we started to talk about too is, do you know how much they're actually doing in coordination?
I assume they're talking with another. I'm assuming they're sharing information. It wouldn't surprise me if states that have masks or states that have certain resources are kind of lending them.
Yep, sharing.
States, but I have no idea.
When I've read that, I started to wonder if, in fact, this could start to shape a different kind of federalism.
It could. Yeah. You know, one could imagine that. But September 11th was supposed to be a defining moment in American history. You can make certain arguments as to why that was true, but it certainly didn't last, obviously, in terms of saying we're all in this together, we're one strong, united country. George Bush, God help us, looks like a paragon of leadership compared to Donald Trump. And to give him credit, or what I really hate to say, is to give Rudolph Giuliani some credit. They both stepped up to the occasion immediately after September 11th and said what they should have said and created a quite remarkable national unity that didn't depend on oppressing minorities.
Yeah.
That's not the United States we have today. And so who knows what the outcome of this will be?
Well, Sandy Levinson, it's always a pleasure to talk with you and to get your wisdom. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. Sandy Levinson is a professor of law and political science at the University of Texas. He's the author of Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, and approximately 400 articles, book reviews, and commentaries in professional and popular journals. When we come back, April is perhaps the most notorious month for victims of genocide. We'll analyze why genocides happen and how they might be prevented in the future. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. April has been a very dark month for victims of genocide. On April 24, 1915, Turkish authorities began their systematic annihilation of the Armenians in Turkey. On April 7, the Rwandan Hutu power government began exterminating the Tutsi population. In Cambodia, Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime launched its genocidal efforts on April 17. April was also the month that Serb leader Slobodan Milosevic began the Serb offensive to eliminate the Muslim communities in parts of Bosnia. Why does genocide happen, and how can it be prevented? With us are three experts. Ben Kiernan is professor of history and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. He is the author of Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur, Cambodia, the Eastern Zone Massacres, and the Pol Pot Regime, Race, Power, and Genocide in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, 1975 to 1979. Alex Hinton is the executive director of the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University. He is the author of Why Did They Kill? Cambodia in the Shadow of Genocide and editor of Genocide, Truth, Memory, and Representation, and Annihilating Difference, The Anthropology of Genocide. Simon Baron-Cohen is a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity College. He is the author of The Science of Evil, On Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty, and 0 Degrees of Empathy. He's also editor of Understanding Other Minds and the Maladaptive Mind. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Ben Kiernan. You've identified 4 primary factors or themes when you've looked across genocides, although you say each are unique. What would you say those primary themes or factors are?
Well, in terms of the mindset of the perpetrators of genocide, the people who later go on to commit genocide or implement genocidal policies, some of the preoccupations and ideas that surface early in their careers and seem to be pointers to their later actions include, for instance, racial hatred or religious prejudice. Obviously, that's part of the definition of genocidal violence against an ethnic or religious or national or racial group. But other factors in the mindset of perpetrators that I found coming up again and again over a long survey of several millennia of genocidal occurrences, not only the racial and religious prejudice, but also an expansionist drive to take over territory. And along with that, a ideological obsession with how the land should be used, not just taking it over and ruling it or even expelling or killing the indigenous population, but also the fact that the correct usage of that land, and it's often agricultural cultivation, and so this leads to a prejudice against urban dwellers or hunter-gatherers, neither of whom are farming populations. And in many cases, not all, genocidal perpetrators have a fetish about cultivation. And along with that, a fourth factor is the kind of obsession with the ancient past of the ethnic group of the perpetrators, which what I call a cult of antiquity, an idea that there was a glorious past that the modern-day perpetrators of genocide, in whatever era they might be in, they're looking back at a glorious past that they want to recapture. And that often has a philosophical connection with their ethnicity, the origins of their ethnic group, which they want to reclaim the glory days of. And it also has something to do with the territory they allegedly once occupied and committing genocide against so-called intruders or people who get in the way of reclaiming that territory and that ancient ethnic purity.
Even the ethnic wars that didn't turn completely genocidal had a component of, say, the greater Serbia or the greater Croatia, greater Bosnia. But those may have not been completely accurate.
Oh, yes, they're often mythical. Sometimes there's a kernel of truth or more than a kernel of truth. Sometimes they're just invented. But quite often there is a kind of irredentist claim that goes along with the expansionism in the sense that this was once our territory. On the other hand, these four factors, when they're together, that's racism, expansionism, the obsession with antiquity and cultivation, they're powerful and explosive as a mix, but sometimes in isolation, just one or even two of the factors don't produce a genocidal outcome. And that's important to note, that even discrimination may not be more than an obsession. It might not even be practiced, and therefore it cannot always lead to genocide. But in combination with a militaristic expansionism, for instance, racial prejudice can be extremely virulent.
Alex Hinton, let's bring you in. How does this comport with your studies?
I'm writing a book that focuses on Doik, who was the commandant of a prison camp in Cambodia, S21, which is now commonly known as Tuol Sleng. And I've sort of looked at three issues. One is, how does genocide come about? And Professor Kiernan has very nicely described a number of the key factors. The second thing is, how do people come to perpetrate acts of genocide and mass violence? And then I'm also looking now at notions of justice and the aftermath of conflict. From an anthropological perspective, I would look also at the way that difference is constructed. As Professor Kiernan was pointing out, that a genocidal regime will envision difference in a certain way so that people belong to the group, in-group, out-group. As it does so, usually the message, the ideological blueprint that they've devised, begins to resonate more with people in a context of socioeconomic upheaval. When a regime has come to power, typically they begin to manufacture difference. Differences that people might not otherwise be as aware of suddenly come into the foreground and are actually become linked to ideological messages and often structural messages, legal messages. So people begin to be differentiated in very specific sorts of ways.
Can you give some examples of those so people can understand?
So I'm going to talk about situations where genocide hasn't occurred, but the processes I'm talking about are all around us. With the events taking place in Boston, we have 9/11 as an example in the United States. Immediately in the aftermath of the bombing in Boston and then the seeking suspects, then two brothers have been located and they're being coded as Muslim and Chechenian or from somewhere in that region. Most people probably have never heard of Chechnya, and suddenly that identity is foregrounded. It's something people become aware of, and it becomes fixed and differentiated. It's an us-them differentiation. That's 9/11 with the perception of Muslims and Arab Americans. The same sort of thing went on. And in genocide, it's taken to the extreme. So you have differences in awareness of other sorts of beings through an identity position are foregrounded. They become marked. By this, I mean dehumanized in certain sorts of ways, stigmatized in society. And as part of the blueprint of the ideological regime, and I should just note on the side as well, what I'm talking about is particularly applicable to what are called ideological genocide, colonial genocides, for example. The other thing is then people are rounded up and often confined. They're marked as other, and then the process can begin of eliminating those people. You know, another way sometimes I think about it through the acronym BPERP. B is in belief, the ideological beliefs and the personal views of the perpetrators. The PER is the perspective of people, the way in which the others defined by ideology and those messages are taken in by individual perpetrators. And the last P in BPERP is for position, and that's the person, the structural position the person occupies in the system and the position of the victim. And those three things interact over time, and the foregrounding of one of those three factors can be more prominent within a given context.
One other aspect that you had done in your work pertained to the psychosocial phenomena like honor, what you called face. How do these come into play? Honor particularly seems like it would be a contradiction to genocide, but you found them intertwined in some way.
Absolutely. One of the things that often emerges in explanations of mass violence and especially genocide, the notion that there's no meaning to it, it's meaningless. On a radio station, there was a student in Boston who said there's no logic to this. There is a logic. There are sets of cultural understandings that inform action. One of the things that a perpetrator regime will need to do as they envision difference, when they're envisioning difference, is they need to cast their ideology, in the case of the Khmer Rouge, for example, Marxist-Leninism, was extreme in a way that people on the ground are going to understand. So if you're trying to appeal to peasants who don't have a great degree of formal education but may have been educated in the pagoda, as was the case, these terms are taken and molded and adapted so that they're going to resonate with local conceptions. Among the things that perpetrator regime may play upon are notions of status, which is linked to honor, face. People often think of genocide, mass murder, as if there are these maniacal ideologues who come about and manipulate a bunch of followers who blindly do whatever they say, but it's much more complicated than that. It's actually difficult to try and motivate people to do things that otherwise go against at least some of their beliefs, and this is a struggle that many perpetrator regimes have to deal with, and it changes through time, and sometimes it leads to the downfall of the group.
Simon Baron-Cohen, let's bring you in. You've been looking at the psychological basis of cruelty, of evil. You've identified a missing component among people who perpetrate these things, and that is empathy. How does it happen that people fail to either develop empathy or that develop the loss of empathy?
The points that Ben and Alex have made sit very comfortably within the framework of empathy. They've really been highlighting social factors that can lead an individual to lose their empathy in certain situations. Ben was talking about racism as one of his four factors. If the propaganda around racism is potent enough, you can lose your empathy for the other person, the person in the out-group. And Alex was talking about a very social, psychological perspective, in-group, out-group relations, that often when a racist propaganda is being created, the out-group will be described in very dehumanized language so that the in-group have reduced empathy for members of the out-group. And I think we saw that in genocides like Rwanda, where the propaganda was describing one ethnic group as subhuman, and you know, once you no longer see the person as a person, but see them as a subhuman or an object, then of course you become capable of treating them as an object. And I think that the missing component in the discussion so far is about the brain. I'm a neuroscientist, and what we've seen in recent research is a greater understanding of the brain basis of empathy. And what you can see when you image the brain whilst the individual is looking at somebody else and responding to someone else's emotions is that we all vary in how much empathy we have and in how much the empathy circuit in the brain is activated, for example, if we see somebody else in distress. So there are individual differences in empathy, and it may be some of those social, psychological factors, in-group, out-group relations, racism, you know, these kinds of things. For some individuals, it'll be enough to push them even lower down that empathy bell curve so that they become capable of hurting another person.
So what you're saying is that empathy can actually be turned off.
That's right. I mean, there are individual differences in empathy. There are different ways of measuring it, either using questionnaires or other kinds of psychological tests. And what you find is that some people have a lot of empathy, some people have just average amounts, and some people are starting off much lower, below average. But then there are situational factors that can make an individual have more or less empathy in a given situation. And, you know, when we try to make sense of why some people lose their empathy or fail to develop it in the first place, we have to look at both individual factors, for example, their genetics, their biology, but also these social factors.
I think two things arise from that. One is, on a mass level, how can empathy be erased? Is that what psychologists talk about when they talk about mob behavior or intergroup emotions that comes into play? And can empathy then be turned on for those people who may have previously had it shut off?
Both questions are really good. You know, the first one about crowd behavior. If you're in a group and you feel under threat, it's going to be hard to sustain your empathy for those who you believe are threatening you. So if the propaganda is telling you that the other group is about to attack, about to invade, they're about to even attack your family, you have a very primitive reaction biologically. Your cortisol hormone increases to get you ready for fight or flight. And in that condition, in that state, it's much harder to remember or to stay focused on the other person's feelings. All you want to do is defend yourself and defend those who you love. Whereas in other conditions, for example, peace or post-genocide, if there's a kind of reconciliation process where you come face-to-face with the victim, your empathy could recover, where you begin to see the person, as a victim, with all of their subjectivity.
We certainly saw a little bit of that in South Africa during the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. It wasn't a genocide per se, but some horrible human rights conditions. Alex Hinton, let me bring you back in for just a moment, because this sort of ties to what you called psychosocial dissonance. What is that, and how is it related to genocidal activity?
No, that's very relevant to the discussion. The notion of psychosocial dissonance speaks to Festinger's notion of cognitive dissonance, but places it into a socio-cultural context. So in other words, if people have different belief structures and they're brought into tension, it creates a dissonance. So one obvious thing that takes place in situations of mass violence and genocide is that most people then socialize not to kill or harm other human beings, in one sense, but then they're put in a context where they're told that, for example, these aren't really human beings, they're evil enemies, microbes, viruses, so on and so forth. And that goes back to the marking of difference. But there's still a tension that someone still, in some sense, may or may not see a human being. And if they see them that way and they're told they're an enemy and need to be killed, it may create a dissonance, a tension within them that needs to be resolved. And there are a number of different cognitive steps they can take. I think empathy is absolutely critical, as are other emotions like shame, and findings from neuroscience, psychopathology, are directly relevant. But I'm a little bit wary that there's a tendency for things to become overly biologized and for people to give primacy to something. And I'm not saying that Simon is doing this. I'm saying that it's something that exists with many people, where people want to look for the genetic roots of different things. And I think there's a danger that if that factor, which can be relevant in different ways, is taken and given primacy, it can then divert our attention from absolutely key social, cultural, and historical factors that are operative. And I sort of just put that caveat in. So it's not to disagree with Simon, but to say that for people who are listening, that we do have this cultural bias that exists in our society where we like to biologize things. And in terms of understanding genocide and mass violence, it's important not to have that come in and frame our understanding, or we'll lose sight of other important factors.
But rather just to understand that these are all contributors, and they're all things that we need to understand together as a construction of what we see in the world.
Absolutely. There are certain ways in which myths like Lord of the Flies, where you have this notion that people can have civilization, but they're brought, these kids go to this island, and suddenly the veneer of civilization is removed and people are acting upon their baser evolved instincts. So we have these ways of thinking that float around, and again, there are ways in which factors linked to biology and evolution, emotion, neuropsychology are all relevant, but it jives with what people tend to think with their common folk understandings. I think that's an important caveat to put in there.
A quick reminder, this is The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the forces of genocide. There have been a number of genocides that have remained either unacknowledged or under-acknowledged or flat-out denied. Ben Kiernan, you've written about Native Americans. There's the Armenian genocide in Australia, considerable denial of what happened with the Aborigines people. First of all, remind us of what did occur, and then give us a sense of what the cost is of unacknowledgement, under-acknowledgement, or flat-out denial.
I would just like to quickly refer to what both Simon and Alex were just saying, if I could, because they both made a lot of sense to me. Alex talking about the broader historical factors, and Simon talking about empathy and the different gradations of empathy amongst different people. And I think that makes it hard for genocidal groups to recruit in normal situations. And what happens is that they tend to only thrive in the conditions of historical and social upheaval. War, massive destabilization, economic upheaval. In the Cambodian case, it was the massive intrusion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia and the widespread bombing that took place. And that enabled the Khmer Rouge to recruit supporters, but they also had to work on the existing empathy of many of those supporters by telling them who to attack and who was responsible for the bombing and so on. And they deliberately did that in telling the population they were recruiting, whose villages had been bombed and whose families had been uprooted, that they were being attacked not by the United States Air Force, but by the Phnom Penh population, the capital city, and the population there. And that turned a lot of the violence of the attacked peasantry against the cities. In terms of the number of genocides that have occurred in the 20th century, sometimes these are disguised or hidden behind wars. So it's often thought in some cases that such and such a genocide was not a genocide but a civil war. Often both are going on. They're not necessarily one or the other, but overlapping factors. One of the things that genocide studies and the field has uncovered over the last 50 years or so, particularly since the work of Raphael Lemkin, who really began this in the 1940s and was instrumental in having the Genocide Convention become international law, is that there were a large number of cases in history, and indeed since the Genocide Convention has become law, of genocide breaking out. Now, one of those that was for long not given the attention that it deserved was the genocide in Guatemala, for which a former president of Guatemala is actually the first former head of state in the Americas to face trial for genocide. And the destruction of indigenous populations in Guatemala in the 1980s is still an event that hasn't got the attention that it deserves. I think it's true of many indigenous cases. Not all colonial or conquests of indigenous peoples led to genocide, but a number of them did, both in the Australian continent and in North America and Central and South America as well. And the genocide in Guatemala only 30 years ago is a kind of reflection of one of the worst cases of that.
In terms of people who dissent or try to stop genocidal activity, what can we learn from them? I'll start with Alex.
I also wanted to return to your question about genocides that are out of focus, because I think it taps into a key thread that's emerging within the field of genocide studies. Some people have referred to it as critical genocide studies. And one part would be sort of informed by the Frankfurt School and critical theory, but another part focuses more on sort of destabilizing the tacit presuppositions of the field and the categories that lead us to look at things in certain sorts of ways. Just briefly, there has, for a long time, in some sense, been a model of genocide that's informed by the Holocaust, with Auschwitz being the, through metonymy, standing for sort of epitomizing what genocide is. And I think that informed the UN Genocide Convention. And linked to this, people often talk about referring to some cases of mass violence as genocide, saying, well, if we call too many things genocide, it will dilute the meaning of the term. I call this the dilution metaphor, and it's sort of a gatekeeping metaphor and one that has ontological resonance in the sense that we all know what an impurity is, and it's something that we're familiar with. But there's no reason why we shouldn't necessarily, if cases fit a definition, referred to them as genocide. So it's this gatekeeping notion. And I think a real shift in genocide studies has been that people are starting to look at a much larger range of cases. You know, at the center I direct, we recently had a conference, and there's a volume coming out called Hidden Genocides. Another scholar has a book called Forgotten Genocides. Ben has the volume that's been really critical in this move of sort of looking at the broad historical purview of genocide in a variety of different contexts, and probably has, you know, the foundational text. This has been a big shift to look at these sort of cases that are off the map that we haven't looked at because we have certain sorts of biases and preconceptions.
Knowing what we know psychologically, neurologically, sociologically, politically, Simon Baron-Cohen, what can we do to prevent genocide?
Just before I move to that question, the previous question was about hidden genocides or genocides that are off the radar. And I just wanted to mention that it's the anniversary, as we know, of the Armenian genocide. And it's just an opportunity for your listeners to if they don't know about it, to go and read about it and learn about it. This is the Turkish Holocaust, it might be called, against the Armenians back in 1915, when Turkey constructed 25 concentration camps just outside of Turkey's border in Syria, with resulting huge numbers of Armenians being killed. So we just need to remember some of these other Holocausts that don't get the media attention that, for example, the Nazi Holocaust did and does. And to me, this reminds me that the risk of genocide is in every culture. It's not about a specific culture, and maybe that's the kind of link to prevention, that if we can identify, as Alex started out doing, some of the factors that together make a very potent risk, and start to educate people to watch out for these things in certain situations, that might be one step towards prevention. That when the media and when governments are using propaganda, history can show us that we can easily fall for it, but equally, once the analysis is laid out, you can then reflect, and that might be one step to guard against just succumbing to the impact of propaganda.
Ben Kiernan?
Along with the hidden genocides, there are also the hidden rescues, indeed the hidden rescuers and the hidden resistance. There's a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times by Marcy Shore, which talks about the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and she actually makes the point that although in some ways it was a hopeless cause, it did delay for several months the deportations from Warsaw to Auschwitz. We need to give more attention to the people who rescued victims or resisted and in fact inflicted casualties on the perpetrators and perhaps delayed or even offset or reduced the number of victims. That's one of the ways to look at prevention, is to study what it is that makes rescue possible and what kinds of people respond to requests to rescue or hide or otherwise shelter or help potential victims. One of the other aspects of genocide, at least as known in the public arena, is the lack of information about resistance. There were, in many cases, resistance movements that sprung up against genocide perpetrators and their regimes, whether it was in Bangladesh or East Timor or Cambodia or under the Nazi Holocaust or elsewhere. The people who try to prevent on the spot the deportation or murder of genocide victims really deserve more attention than they've got.
And Alex Hinton.
I agree with my colleague. I would just add that critical self-reflection is an absolutely key thing, because many of the dynamics that are taken to the extreme in genocide are around us all the time. Peer pressure is just an example, bullying, so on and so forth. Awareness of what's occurred in general through educational initiatives enhances the awareness of what potential exists in different societies and how genocide sometimes can come on fairly quickly. In other cases, it has a much longer duration. The notion that Simon foregrounded of empathy, I think, is absolutely critical. And from my anthropological frame, I would also sort of cast that in terms of this notion of understanding how we envision difference in different sorts of ways, how difference is crystallized, but to come to try and understand other people as opposed to readily going along with whatever ways difference is being catalyzed. And certainly in Boston, that's something that's being debated, and even though, again, that's not a case of genocide, but that dynamic is one that you find taken to the extreme in genocide. Another key factor is international apathy, where people just don't care, or it's not a quote-unquote strategic priority and people don't pay attention to it. I might conclude by noting that, in a sense, genocide prevention always fails, because if there's ever a successful genocide prevention, we'll never know.
You mentioned the international apathy. Do you think that the move towards tribunals and the International Criminal Court are having an impact on reducing either a full-out genocide or at least the kinds of mass human rights abuses that we have seen?
I think people's common folk perceptions, our ways of understanding, is that, yes, if you bring people to justice, it will fight impunity and act as a deterrence. And there's certainly some truth to that, but at the same time, I wouldn't want to just say, oh, we have this one thing and it will always work. That's one among a number of factors that need to be attended to. And in some ways, it's one that is often foregrounded. So it's great that we have these initiatives to have justice. Been the case, you know, in some of the cases, like Guatemala or Cambodia right now, Argentina, the question immediately arises, why did it take so long to get to this point? So all the events that occurred during those years beforehand, they're historical events, political events, and they're questions that need to be asked about why it is that only now we're getting at this moment in time. It's not to say it's not good that we have it, but I think by only focusing on what's going on with the tribunals, we erase other things that may be directly relevant, including, for example, geopolitics.
One of the things we didn't talk about was the legitimation of political violence in certain circumstances. And let me just do a final comment. Simon Baron-Cohen?
One point made earlier, I think by Alex, was that we shouldn't let biology take any primacy. And I would agree with that, that whether we're taking a sociological or anthropological or a biological approach, none of these have primacy. They're all just contributing factors in the mix.
And Ben Kiernan.
Absolutely. Multi-pronged prevention is the only way to go. I think it's the Human Security Report, sponsored by the UN, came up with the conclusion that the number of genocides has slightly decreased in the late 90s and in the 21st century, and that may have something to do with the first international criminal tribunals for both Bosnia and Rwanda. But also, I think it's got something to do with the end of the Cold War, or more importantly, perhaps an awareness that conflict has to be avoided, that there needs to be attention given to not starting new wars, that there needs to be attention given to resolution of poverty and other historical and social problems that allow genocidal perpetrators to recruit supporters. I think that's absolutely key.
Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your work. Alex Hinton, Ben Kiernan, Simon Baron-Cohen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ben Kiernan is professor of history and the director of the Genocide Studies Program at Yale University. He is the author of Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur. Alex Hinton is the executive director of the Center for the Study of Genocide, Conflict Resolution, and Human Rights. He is professor of anthropology and global affairs at Rutgers University and a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University. He is the author of Why Did They Kill? Cambodia in the Shadow of Genocide. Simon Baron-Cohen is a professor of developmental psychopathology at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity College. He is the author of The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty and 0 Degrees of Empathy. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper and Ankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.